Welcome to A Big Heart, a podcast about living with heart disease. I'm Mike Papali, and I'm the president and founder of In a Heartbeat, a nonprofit organization with a mission to prevent death from sudden cardiac arrest. I went into sudden cardiac arrest at age 17 and have been living with heart disease for over a decade. This podcast will dissect the physical and emotional obstacles of living with heart disease and how to overcome them. I am inviting you to join me on my personal journey of living as a heart disease patient. The ultimate goal of this podcast is to help heart disease patients of all ages live a long and normal life. Welcome everyone to the next episode of A Big Heart, a podcast about living with heart disease. A Big Heart is powered by In a Heartbeat. In a Heartbeat is a nonprofit organization with the mission to prevent death from sudden cardiac arrest. This is done by donating AEDs, providing CPR and AED training, raising money for research projects, providing support to patients, and offering free ECGs to children, teens, and young adults. To learn more about In a Heartbeat, visit www.inaheartbeat.org. Welcome back, podcast family. I appreciate you being here for another episode of A Big Heart. We have a really cool episode ahead of us. We're back to doing some inspiring interviews with some people that definitely have some really, really interesting stories and experiences that I truly believe a lot of our listeners can relate to. So before we get to that, I just want to make a quick announcement that my memoir, A Big Heart, is officially for sale. It's been officially published. It became available on September 1st, and it's available by a bunch of different retailers, Amazon, Kobo, Google Play, Apple Books, and Barnes & Noble. So the best way to order a copy is to visit www.abigheartbook.com. When you get there, you can purchase either directly from me or you can order from one of the retailers. So we've had some great feedback so far. And like I've said in previous episodes, similar to this podcast, I really want the book to be a valuable resource for all heart disease patients, sudden cardiac arrest survivors, patients living with an ICD, as well as their families. So please feel free to spread the word to anyone who you think might be interested. And again, that's www.abigheartbook.com. All right, so for today's episode, we have a great interview with an author, an advocate, an entrepreneur. She's got an incredible and inspiring story prior to her sudden cardiac arrest, which of course she survived. And she shares all of that in her interview. So her name is Tess Casso. She is the author of a series of children's books, which I'm not going to tell you about because she explains them all in the interview. She's a volunteer for the American Heart Association. Like I said, she's a cardiac arrest survivor, and she's done a lot of things since her cardiac arrest, which was just about 1 year ago. So she's awesome, and I hope you all enjoy listening to her story. So here she is, Tess Casso. Okay, we now welcome on a very special guest, Tess Casso. Tess, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Of course. So you have, and wear, I should say you wear a lot of hats. You're an author, an entrepreneur, and an advocate. So we're going to talk a little bit about everything. But the first thing I want to talk about is you've published two amazing children's books. And the main character, it seems, in each book is Ferris. So could you tell us kind of just like the inspiration behind wanting to become an author and about Ferris?
Sure. My journey to becoming an author comes from personal experiences. My husband and I wanted to have a family, and we realized that we were not able to do it naturally, and quickly found out several years ago that we both suffer from infertility. And in vitro fertilization, or IVF, was the only way in which we had any possibility of me carrying a child. And we went through IVF and was able to conceive our son, Ferris, with my very last embryo that I had. And as I was drawing back on the situation that we were dealt, I realized I wanted to someday explain this to my son, how he came to be, because it was a very unique experience, one that I knew nothing about until I was living through it. And I realized that there was nothing available to children in the forms of a storybook to tell them how they came to be if they were conceived via IVF. So I put pen to paper and took my business background and my knowledge of literature and writing. And then I created the I'm Very Ferris Children's Picture Book series, in which IVF is in the title. And it is a rhyming picture book series for children. And I've even actually been told adults have used it to help explain what IVF is, but it tells infertility through a child's perspective to help families talk about IVF to their children, because it may be foreign to some people, but 1 in 8 couples experience infertility. And IVF also can be a factor used for same-sex couples, for single moms or single dads by choice. So it's more prevalent out there than I think a lot of people realize. And the opportunity to use my books to help explain to a child how they came to be was really my mission and my goal. And we're 2 books in now into the series, and it's not over yet. I have ideas and working on a 3rd one to be released. And just really happy with the responses that my idea has gotten from people all over the globe.
That's awesome. So I think it's really cool because you're teaching kids at a young age that, you know, it's okay if, you know, maybe you're not able to, if you're infertile, or, you know, there's other ways to have children, and teaching kids at a, you know, very young age, can only help, right, as they grow and if they potentially have to go through that. I guess what advice would you give, you know, a young family that's trying to have children and is struggling? Because I'd imagine there's a lot of, you know, both physical and mental obstacles that kind of come with that, and frustrations and tons of different emotions. So what advice would you give someone going through what you all went through?
I would advise them to be patient and to understand, because when you want something and it's not going to happen, and it's perhaps not going to happen as fast as maybe people around you or people that you know, or people maybe even in your own realm of friends or family that have experienced pregnancy or having a child, and then you want it and it's not going to happen as easily, you need to be patient with infertility and you need to understand all the options to you. My husband and I were not candidates for something called IUI, which is usually a first step before in vitro fertilization. We had to go right to IVF if we were going to at all try to conceive, because there were problems both sides of us. You know, there is surrogacy out there, there's adoption, there's egg and sperm and embryo donation. There's so much out there, and it can be so overwhelming when all you're thinking about is starting a family, and all this stuff means, you know, just words flying through your head. Most of it's going to include medicine for the woman, injections for the woman. The man is going to have to go in as well to have sperm evaluations. And, you know, there can be surgeries for both. It's just very financially taxing. And depending on whether or not you have insurance to cover this and how much insurance you have to cover it. And I think growing up, and there was a world in which all this talk was hush hush. You don't talk about that stuff in public. It's embarrassing. You wouldn't say the word uterus, or you wouldn't, like I said, you wouldn't say embryo. But the truth is this is just the human anatomy. And I think that in raising a child, to talk about this kind of stuff is appropriate for children to understand, and not to go into this thinking, oh, we giggle at that kind of thing, or if we don't talk about that. So when you're suffering with infertility, one, you realize you're not alone, and that's part of the understanding of it. There's so many support groups out there. This can be a diagnosis that you did not cause. You did not have to have done anything to yourself to have made this happen. Some of us are born with it. Some of us, you know, are in our genetics. But to be patient, because this is a long road. I have friends currently going through it on secondary infertility, meaning they were able to conceive naturally for their first child, but now they would like to expand their family and they can't. And so they're looking at infertility routes and asking me questions and realizing that it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to be a romantic thing. Maybe it's going to require lots of pricks and probing and evaluations and early appointments and take this, don't take that. So that's where the understanding comes in. And from there, again, support groups and family or church or meditation, whatever it is that you rely on to be calm and understand things, resources are out there. And I would strongly advise people to utilize them.
Definitely. What about someone, so, you know, there's a family that is kind of contemplating whether or not they're going to go through with IVF. And what would you tell them about your experience that might help them take like that final step to actually kind of start that process?
I'm not sure anyone could have gone into the process quite as clueless as me. So knowing I know so much more after the other end than I did going into it. I remember sitting in the fertility doctor's office and just like everything was flying over my head. I had no idea what I literally went to Google. What is IVF? I had no idea what this stuff was. I didn't grow up with it. Maybe, I don't know if it's because of a religious background or my family didn't have any issues conceiving, so we just didn't talk about it. But I didn't know anything about this stuff. I felt like, is there something wrong with me? And unfortunately, I had some people that thought there's something wrong with her. And that's so unfair. It's not appropriate. The opportunity for me to have a very strong support system in my husband and my partner, my spouse, to be there with me through appointments early in the morning. I mean, we were doing 6 a.m. appointments at that time. I was working in downtown Chicago and taking the train. And so we were scheduling things all around my work schedule. And he would be there as often as he could and be there to help me with injections. And we made it kind of a family event. We had a little dog at the time and he would be there in the room with us. So, he was very supportive and I had very good insurance and we just made the decision, you know, we were going to go through this one time because of our ages and our biological systems. And I knew mentally and physically, this was going to have a toll on me. And I only wanted to do it once. And then I was going to move on to other options that I might need to look at. And I did not have to do that at the end, but you know, I was so unaware of the things out there. And now after the fact, I see so many support, again, groups, books, counselors, holistic things that are there. And it doesn't matter where you're at in the world, they're out there. And with the power of social media, even more so. So, I would advise people to take a deep breath and, you can do this, whether you have a full-time job or you don't, whether you work from home or you're in an office, it can be done. It requires discipline and time and commitment, but it can be done. The only thing is that this is a step that you take in life that you don't necessarily guarantee the result. And that's also the really hard thing to understand, is that you can do all the things right and it still might not give you a baby. So it's an emotional thing, and to have a good support group on you is, I think, a very necessary thing.
Definitely. And how old is your son now?
He is 3.
3. Okay. Wow. So you got to go through this whole process, which is like we've been talking about, physically and mentally taxing on both you and your husband. And you have your son, and you know, I'd imagine at that point things seem like life is going pretty normal. And I was just actually looking at the date on October 10th, right? 2020, which is just about a year from a year ago, you went into sudden cardiac arrest out of nowhere. Could you just talk us through that story, what happened and kind of how it all went down?
Sure. So right, I am riding along in life with a 2-year-old. We had just moved to Indianapolis here from, I actually moved to Carmel outside of Indy from Chicago in April of 2020. I published that second book in the series in April. My husband had a job transfer and we took it, and I, working from home, was able to relocate to a beautiful home office, and everything was going great. And then our dog, the one I mentioned, who has been in on all the fertility journey and life with us, he passed away unexpectedly in my arms 3 days before this next set of events took place. So it was very traumatic, and yet just another card that life has dealt us. And that Saturday, October 10th, my husband and I and my son, we decided to get pumpkins for our house, being that it's fall and want to decorate, and I don't really know much around the area still. So we went to a farm, met my parents who still live in Chicago because it's a good halfway point for us. We see them about once a month so they could see Ferris. And I was pulling a wagon to the pumpkin patch empty, and I was just a normal day. Nothing was different than normal as far as food consumption or coffee or whatnot. And suddenly I had extreme pain in my left arm, and that was the arm I was using to pull the wagon. But then I felt really, really heavy chest pain, and I knew something was wrong. And I knew these are signs of a heart attack, but I just wasn't believing it in my head that this was happening, and it didn't go away. And, you know, my parents were there and they were in disbelief. And my dad thought I was having like an antacid, I needed antacid pills. He thought it was like an acid reflux or something. And I was in so much pain. My husband said, this is not that. I've never seen her like this before. And I was buckled over and I could hardly talk or breathe. It hurt so bad. And, my husband knew right away, I got to call 911 because I know you have a high tolerance for pain, but this isn't like I've ever seen you before. Mm-hmm. And it took about 45 minutes before an ambulance got out. I'm in the middle of nowhere at a pumpkin patch. And when they got there, they gave me some nitroglycerin, mm-hmm. and ran an EKG and saw there was some damage to the heart muscle. And I needed to go to a hospital equipped for the cardiology department, and the local hospital in that county wasn't. So they took me 20 minutes farther. So now I was 2 hours from my home, and I'm in Eastern time zone here in Carmel, and now I'm in Central time zone. So I was like, oh my God, this is a Saturday. All I wanted was pumpkins, my son to see my parents there one day a month. And now I'm in an ambulance going to the hospital, and I have no clue what's happening. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the nitroglycerin had kicked in and I felt fine. All the pain went away. I was great. And I just was like, what is happening? This whole day now is ruined. And got to the ER. I had a great set of ambulance care providers and first responders. And the ER, the nurses were fantastic. And I remember laughing because they were teasing me about the people that were coming and going on the other side of the curtain, like why they were there. You know, a little lady who refused to take her pills, a guy who smokes packs a day, and they're like, well, you wouldn't be here if you would stop smoking. And like all these things these people were having coming in, and the nurses were joking in my ear because they were self-inflicted kind of results of why they were there. And here I was sitting there with heart issues, and they just told me that they wanted to keep me overnight because they needed to run additional tests and they didn't have that staff that day. And luckily, you know, in COVID that they didn't send me home. So my husband said goodbye to me. Those first responders in the ambulance said goodbye to me. And this was going to be the first time I'd be away from my son overnight. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was like, really? This is how it's going to go down. This first night is me in the hospital. And so I never actually got to say goodbye to him because my husband kept him from seeing me get into the ambulance on the stretcher and things like that. He wasn't quite sure how he could handle it. Yeah. And my parents did a good job of keeping our son, my son, occupied in that car. So they said goodbye to me and they left. And my husband's like, I'll be back tomorrow and I'll bring your laptop so you have something to do. Cause I was working on a speech for something. Mm-hmm. And it was like, okay, this is how Saturday's playing out. And it's really from that point that I go blank and I always rely on my husband to tell me this story. So it's his knowledge telling me what he lived and saw. I remember calls from my family at night and I remember them telling me what they were doing. My parents decided to stay with my son so my husband could come back the next day. Cause again, this is now a 2 hour each way drive for me. It's not like I'm 10 minutes from home where the local hospital is here. Apparently when the nurses were moving me from the ER to a regular room, unhooked up to anything, I must have started complaining of chest pains again. Mm-hmm. And they were putting me in a new bed is when I went into cardiac arrest. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I'll ever know, but, and my husband doesn't know either, but they did several compressions on me. They said they were about 2-inch deep compressions and therefore my ribs got broken. And then they had to do the defibrillator shocks on me to get my heart back. And they did, but my breathing breaths per minute were not at the number that they needed to be. So they gave me a ventilator, put me in a drug-induced coma, and then called my husband. And that's what my husband got a call at like 11:50, October 10th at night. And everything went slow. And he wanted to leave right then and there. And they told him, you know, she's stable. You've got a 2 hour drive. It's midnight. There's not much you can do. Why don't you try to stay home until like 6 a.m. and then leave? He said one of the hardest things he had to do was climb upstairs to go tell my parents who were decided to stay over to be with my son, mm-hmm. what just happened to their daughter. And, and then the next day to tell my son. So my husband ended up leaving at 6 a.m. the next day. He did not sleep at all. And he says he kept busy by just moving and fiddling and cleaning things. And we have a very clean home. And he said, I just cleaned that stuff. I couldn't.
Yeah.
He had all these things going through his head. Am I about to become a single father? Mm-hmm. Did I just lose my wife? You know, we just moved to this area. He said he prayed for strength to get through whatever was about to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I kind of keep with me is he said he never prayed for what he wanted. He prayed for strength to get through what was about to happen or whatever was meant to happen because mm-hmm. there was nothing more he could do, but he needed the strength to do whatever life was about to hand him. We have a very good friend in the medical field, and Dan, my husband, called that person the next morning, and my friend was able to separate himself from being our friend and be able to give my Dan the medical point of perspective. At that point, Dan had found out that I did not have any signs of any brain damage, and so was kind of getting just a little bit of information as to what he was about to walk in on so he could be prepared. And he said it was just like the movies. He said there were like 50 different machines and lights and sounds going off, and they had my hands strapped to the bed. Was going through so many different tests and stuff and things I'll never remember or know about. But when I finally did come out of the coma, I still had to have the ventilator because the breaths per minute were not there yet, but the drugs had worn off to where I could be awake. Mm-hmm. However, I still have a memory of that because fentanyl and things are so strong that there's no memory of this. But the nurses were joking with my husband saying, I have a surprise and a present for you. And he's like, what could possibly be a surprise and a present in an ICU? And they're like, we have a clipboard. She's awake. You can talk to her with a clipboard. So apparently I was given a clipboard and a pen, and my husband had one, and I just kept writing, where am I? How's Ferris? Mm-hmm. Where's Ferris? Where am I? And it said, I must have answered you like 50, 60 times. Sure. And when over 12 hours have passed, I have small recollection. If I close my eyes, like I can remember, I think the ventilator being pulled out, they asked my husband to step out because it can get graphic and, you know, if someone throws up or whatnot. And I remember waking up, and my memory now comes back, and I remember being in the ICU and him standing over me smiling. And I said, where am I? What happened? And he goes, you don't remember? Do you not remember any? And I said, no. And he said, you went into cardiac arrest. And I remember at that point, there's this wave of emotion. And I am just, you hear that word and you think I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. And that's what I felt like, oh my God, am I going to die? And the truth is I had died.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we went through everything, told me everything. Cardiologists came in, and, you know, this from there, I had 4 days in the ICU of getting my strength back to sit up and get through broken ribs and learning how to breathe. And I left with a life vest and lots of medicine and start the next steps of therapy. And the doctors now here in Indy, because I had to go home and have a whole new set of cardiologists to take a look at my situation and how they were going to diagnose me. And I was diagnosed with cardiomyopathy, specifically Takotsubo, or the broken heart disease. The only thing they can right now can see is that perhaps the loss of our dog, me being so upset and the shock of that creating the cardiomyopathy. However, you know, I said that happened a couple of days before sudden cardiac arrest. Normally that's not the case. Also, a lot of cardiomyopathy patients do not go into cardiac arrest, and I did. So there's a lot of uneven and concern there. My body responded as if someone who does cocaine. I do not do cocaine, but I was asked several times.
Yeah.
So it's like all these things that you have that are, you know, they're trying to put pieces of the puzzle together, and you almost wish they could say, stop and limit your red meat because you have a blockage, or stop smoking because that's what's doing it. But it wasn't any of that. There was nothing they could tell me. So I have to live with a little bit of an unknown and a little bit of knowing I'm also a work in progress, because to this day, again, October 10th will be my 1 year. And not only is the cardiology department here at IU Health working on me, but now my son's cardiologist, who I now have my son see, a specialist, the children's department has asked for access to my files to kind of look through it, because they don't, maybe now there's an idea, maybe it isn't cardiomyopathy, maybe there's something else. And so I live with now an internal defibrillator. As of December 9th, I had a defibrillator surgically implanted in me, and it has a 15-year battery life, and so far it hasn't gone off. And the goal is it doesn't. So I have the full 15 years and get it replaced when I'm in my 50s. And live a long and healthy life. I'm, you know, learning to deal with certain struggles every day, processing things. You know, it's a little emotional. I'm not a crying person, but it's mentally starting to hit me, the 1 year coming up, and dealing with that and learning about different, you know, post-traumatic stress, and thinking about things as we get closer, you know, pumpkins and wagons and things that mean nothing to other people, but now are triggers for me. So it's been an interesting ride, and that I was not prepared for. I was ready to just coast into new life, and then everything switched.
It is amazing to think it's been less than a year for you, because, I mean, you seem like nothing ever happened, which is a good thing, just in the conversations that we've had. I'm just kind of curious, like, what, you know, I guess both from like a physical and like a mental standpoint, from, you know, that day to now, you know, what's kind of like the recovery been like? What have some of the challenges been? And because, you know, you seem like you're living a very normal life, which is awesome.
You know, learning to deal with, I'm an active person. Yeah. I can't sit still. I like to run. Running has been a little tough, and out here in Indiana, it's very hot. There's no more lake effect that I'm used to from Chicago. So dealing with just direct heat all the time on me. So my running has kind of slowed down to fall and winter. And being that this has happened in fall and winter, I haven't really gotten back to the running pace I want. So like recovery mentally with exercise, I'm learning to do a lot of long distance walking and pacing my breath with that. And I'm learning that, you know, I need to take breaks sometimes, and that's hard for me because I don't like to do that, but I'm learning I need to sometimes. And sometimes I get winded and I just need to settle down and take a nap or something. So I'm learning to accept and deal with that and tell myself that's okay. But the physical part, you know, after the surgery for the defibrillator, and getting through that, I mean, there was a point I couldn't wash my hair. I was having my husband try to put my hair in a ponytail because I couldn't lift my arm. And now I can, you know, fully lift my arms, and it's simple things like wash your hair and pick my son up and drive again and work out and be very independent like I'm used to being. I can do that all again. My medication is very low dosages and a very small amount, so I'm very proud of that, and I'd like to continue with that. I have increased my healthy organic lifestyle and clean eating even more so, and just continue doing what I was doing before, but maybe a little bit more even now. But I still live life and still have fun and still try to enjoy every day, because I just have a little bit more appreciation now, knowing that it's not guaranteed that I'm going to be a little old lady someday. I don't know how long I have, and I need to enjoy what I have now, and I really do. And I don't let things bother me perhaps as much as they used to. I don't get as upset anymore, maybe partly because I'm a little bit nervous as to what happens if I do get very emotional. I'm still getting over that, still trying to find my balance, but I feel like I'm doing the best I can with what I have, and I'm also learning through it as well. So so far I'm told the heart is back to normal. Are there days that are more difficult than others? Of course there are. And are there days in which I worry? Sure. But I just keep going and trust that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing and I'm making the right decisions. And that's really the best anybody can do after a big shocking situation.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and part of the comfort of having the ICD is that, you know, you are able to, once you get through like that stage where you can't like lift your arms, and but once you kind of adjust to it, it does give you that sense of security where you can, you know, of course with limitations, but live very normally. It just takes some time to kind of feel that way.
I just joke with people that I can no longer get a bus license or work on power lines, and those dreams are shattered, but other
that's all right. That's all right. You have enough other stuff going on where you probably don't have time for that anyway. So you've, already, again, it's been less than a year, but you've already been involved with the American Heart Association. So you're doing your advocacy work for IVF, and you're also now doing advocacy work for heart disease and women with heart disease. So what's some of the work that you're doing with the AHA?
So I joined in December. I connected with American Heart and Go Red for Women. And I ran in February for the first ever Indianapolis Woman of Impact Award. And I'm very proud to say that I won. I got my very proud of my award. To be the very first one here to do that and to be speaking now and sharing the story of advocacy and helping others is a new purpose and a new goal for me in life. So I've joined forces with them, in which I've done some speaking engagements, and I'm doing a walk later this month for them, and continuing to raise and fundraise for their work and learning more about what they do. And share my story. And they have asked me to be the work in process with them. So literally as I go along, if they want me to speak, I've spoken with their board before. I'm there to share my story as a real life heart disease survivor. And, you know, through my business with testcaso.com and my advocacy, I've decided, you know, to take it into podcast level and bring this awareness that I'm bringing with American Heart into more conversations. And I started a podcast called Titling Tests, and American Heart is aware of that. So I share my heart disease stories there and infertility, as well as other topics that attract women. So I really am taking my life as I go along through these interesting adventures and trying to help other people, but I'm not a doctor and I'm not a nurse and I don't pretend to be one. But I do tell people, you know, I am a real life survivor. I am an intelligent woman. I'm a mother. I'm a wife. I'm a business owner. I have real stories that I can share and perhaps give some people enlightenment or maybe give them a second thought to go and get something checked, or maybe be that comfort or counselor that they need to going through something. And that's really now what I'm doing.
That's awesome. I think to the point you just said, it's very important though, I think that, I mean, doctors and nurses and medical professionals are these like brilliant people that keep their patients safe. So, I mean, I wouldn't be where I am today without my doctors, but I do think your piece of the patient and the real life experience is, I mean, second to none for even just the educational piece for doctors and nurses to hear, you know, how you live your life and the things you've been through. I think that's really important. And then the other piece of it is the importance of raising heart disease, especially for women. And I'm, you know, heavily involved in like cardiac arrest, and there's actual studies out there that show that women are less likely to receive CPR and an AED in the events of cardiac arrest because of the fear of, you know, revealing the chest and, you know, because the pads need to be placed on bare skin. And a lot of the stuff that we are trying to do is like to try to like make sure people understand, like, you know, unfortunately, when someone goes into cardiac arrest, like you said before, you've died, your heart stops, you can't get worse. So a woman, a pregnant woman, you know, they need CPR and AED just as much as anybody else. So there should be no hesitancy to, you know, remove the clothing and to do what you need to do to help save a woman's life if she's in cardiac arrest.
I remember when I gave birth to my son, they, again, it was a first time, I'm a first time mom with him, mm-hmm. He's my only child. And I remember the nurses and doctors going, listen, all modesty goes out the door after this. So just so you're aware, I was like, all right. Anything that happens, I'm just, and that was only the beginning of so many things that my husband would see or witness. Yeah. And you know what, he still loves me. So you're bringing up, it's so true that, you know, if you go down statistics and numbers, you know, if women are, heart disease is the number one killer of women, and they say three women will die of heart disease. Mm-hmm. And yet 38% of research is done on women. And so I remember when I woke up out of cardiac arrest and in the ICU, you know, I was like, where are all my clothes? And they're like, and my husband's like, they are gone. They were ripped off, they're shredded.
Cut.
Think about that. And you think like, the last thing I thought about was any kind of modesty or worrying about like what I looked like and physical and things. It was like, I'm alive, and realizing, you know, and having a son, and giving him equal opportunity to things that, you know, that maybe I didn't grow up with or my mother didn't grow up with. And now the world that we live in today, in the statements that you're making, it's just, women are, we carry a lot of stress on us. It's just, it's how it's kind of been naturally for us, and to not receive the care because of some kind of fictitious idea or something to that regards, like you said, of removing clothes or not seeing this. When it comes down to it, literally every second counts.
Yep.
And the more that we are unconscious or not breathing, the less likely it is that we're going to come back. And so I just strongly believe in the encouragement of people learning CPR and learning how to use a defibrillator. And do you even have a defibrillator near you or in your home, or where is one? How to use one even on someone with a defibrillator. And I've provided classes like that with the American Heart Association to raise money and provide people with the knowledge of this stuff. And, you know, would you know how to do that on an infant versus a 38-year-old versus someone who is older versus a pregnant woman? Mm-hmm. So all this stuff, people, I think, just kind of go, I don't need to worry about that. And it's like, when the time comes and every second counts, are you going to be ready?
Mm-hmm. And 70% of cardiac arrest happens at home. So chances are, you know, you're going to be doing it on somebody that you love. And the most important thing for somebody in that moment is to be empowered to help somebody that you love.
Absolutely.
You know, so the other really important thing you brought up is the symptoms you had, you know, right in the beginning. And just by telling that story is so important, because I think so many of us ignore like the symptoms, the chest pain, the pain in the arm, the shortness of breath, and it's always something else. So the more that like, you're out there telling that story and making people think about, oh, if I feel this, you know, so I need to call 911, that could save somebody's life. Because a lot of times people are stubborn and you always attribute it to something else, right? Like, you know, maybe you worked out earlier that morning or something you ate or whatever, it's stress and related. But it's really important to listen to those heart attack symptoms. This is probably a tough question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. We asked everybody, just if you could give one piece of advice to a sudden cardiac arrest survivor that is recovering and getting ready to live the rest of their life, you know, what's the one piece of advice that you would give?
I would give them reassurance.
Mm-hmm.
Be reassured that you're here for a reason. Mm-hmm. And you, the reassurance to know that you're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. This is such a traumatic experience. And as someone living through it, you know, there are people around me that think it's gone. She's here. It's done. It's over. Mm-hmm. And I know it's not over. And I'm a realist. And my husband, you know, he's like, you know, she still has heart disease. She's still a cardiac arrest survivor. Like, it happened, but there's no telling if it won't happen again and this and that. And you have all these what ifs. And some people can't deal with that. And there's been people in my life that have stepped away. There have been people in my life, like I said, that say, oh, it's over. Why do you keep talking about it? And I would give the advice of reassurance to someone who is waking up with all of these what ifs or fear or panic attacks or, you know, heaviness in breathing or kind of curious how their body's going to be for the rest of life, you know, reassurance that you're going to be okay. And you follow doctor's orders, or you also make your own decisions. You don't have to do everything that is recommended. You have a right to make decisions. That was one of the things my husband said to me, is they were highly recommending this defibrillator. And I was nervous about that. He goes, you have a right to, you don't have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to do it. I felt it was the best thing. And I got over my fear because I was reassured that this is the best step for me. Mm-hmm. So the reassurance to someone that, you know, with groups out there, with therapy, with your own knowledge, there's a lot of ways you can recover. And this isn't as rare as we all once probably thought it was.
Yes.
Looking at both of our photos and speaking, we are not the candidate photos for cardiac arrest people. So it's clearly not that rare. And the more we talk about it, the more people are going to realize that you didn't do anything wrong. Maybe some people did, but maybe you didn't. And it happened to you, and that doesn't mean it's a death sentence again. You can still live a very long and healthy life.
That's awesome. So now I want to make sure we talk about, so you're, again, you're doing all these things that are so great, but how can people find you? And, you know, I include everything. How can they buy your book? How can they listen to your podcast? How could they get involved with what you're doing with the AHA? How could they hire you to speak? And all of that. So what's the best way for people to find you to learn more?
TessCasso.com is my website, and I have everything linked there. I'm on Instagram under that name. Mm-hmm. I'm on Facebook as Tess Casso. I also have an I'm Very Ferris business page and LinkedIn as well. And TessCasso.com can find me to book for speaking engagements. And my American Heart Association advocacy is linked all there as well. And my books are also sold on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. So they ship globally through Amazon as well. Mm-hmm. And that's the best way for email as well to be found there. And I am a real person and check all this stuff all the time. And I read everything, reviews, comments, questions, concerns that are sent to me, direct messages. I read them all because I take what I'm doing very passionately and realize that people out there sometimes just answering a question or a response back can make or break someone's day. And that's such a gift that I am proud to now be at a point in my career where I can do that. And in my life where I'm comfortable in sharing this stuff. So my website's the best way, and know that it will not get overlooked if you reach out to me.
Awesome. And for everyone listening, what we'll do is we'll make sure we link the website in the description of the podcast and on, you know, the podcast Instagram. So all you have to do is open up the description and click, and you'll be right there.
I'm proud that Titling Test is now also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Awesome. When you're doing all this yourself, and then you get these small little wins that, yeah, you know, oh, you're finally on here. I'm like, oh, this is so exciting. Yeah. Only like 5 people I'm on there, but yeah. No, it's we're getting more and more interest. And in my podcast, I feature real life superheroes. Mm-hmm. I consider you a real life superhero. My son is very into superheroes. Mom, I'm a superhero. And these are real life superheroes, people that have survived the most terrifying things and sharing their stories and being real. Those are the ways we connect. There's no filters. There's no, you know, we'll edit this part out so it's a happy ending. This is the stuff people connect to. And that's the kind of thing that I want to be a part of and I want to feature. And that's what I bring.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, Tess, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. All the work you're doing is incredible. Like I said, I don't quite know how you have the time to do everything that you're doing, but it's really awesome. And I'm excited to, you know, listen to the podcast, you know, follow, see the new book, and just follow your journey as you keep going forward. So thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm so happy we connected, and I look forward to perhaps future collaborations as we, you know, life continues to write itself.
Definitely.
Thank you so much for listening to A Big Heart, a podcast about living with heart disease. If you liked this episode, it would mean so much to me if you could give it a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Like anything in life, the goal is to improve. Please provide any feedback you have, any topics you want to hear, or any guests that can provide value to our listeners. You can message us on Instagram at A Big Heart Podcast, or send us an email at mike@inaheartbeat.org. To learn more about In a Heartbeat and the programs we provide, please visit www.inaheartbeat.org. That is www.inaheartbeat.org.